The killing of George Floyd, along with police shootings before and after his death last year, have the issue of qualified immunity back in the spotlight. The legal principle protects police officers and other government officials from many civil lawsuits. A police reform passed by the U.S. House last month would largely do away with that protection that's currently being considered by the Senate. In the meantime, some city and state governments around the country are making their own changes to qualified immunity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should police be largely exempt from civil lawsuits? Do you see a middle ground on the issue? Also want to know how you came to your viewpoint on qualified immunity and policing. What experiences shaped your opinion? Did encounters with the police inform your views? Do you work in law enforcement yourself? Let us know your thoughts and maybe experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Terry Ravenel is a professor of law and the associate dean of faculty research and development at Villanova University. Her areas of expertise include civil and criminal procedure and police conduct. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Terry, I gave a very brief definition of qualified immunity. Can you spell it out a little more for us? What do we mean when we talk about that?
Sure. I think that in order to have a really good understanding of qualified immunity, you have to understand what it's a defense to. So Section 1983, which is the full title, is 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, provides a civil remedy for the deprivation of federally protected rights, including constitutional rights. And one of the things that's really rather extraordinary about this statute is it allows regular people like you and me to bring a civil action against government officials who are acting under the color of state law and deprive them of a federally protected right, including a constitutional right. So it basically becomes the vehicle by which people can enforce constitutional rights. And the thing that's really amazing about it is it's not only a remedy that allows for monetary damages or compensation for actual injuries. Theoretically, it also allows a remedy for injunctive relief. And so that's sort of the basis of the statute, which is actually a Reconstruction era statute that was enacted back in 1871 following the Civil War. And then the qualified immunity doctrine is an affirmative defense to damages actions for violations of that statute. And so what qualified immunity allows a defendant to do is to basically say, yes, I did violate the Constitution, but even if I did deprive you of your constitutional rights, I didn't know that I was depriving you of your constitutional rights because the law wasn't sufficiently clear at the time that I engaged in the alleged conduct. And the court has reasoned that it is unfair to hold a government official liable for conduct that they, in fact, could not have known was unconstitutional at the time of the alleged behavior. And so that's sort of a nutshell version of both the civil remedy, 42 U.S. Section 1983, and the accompanied affirmative defense of qualified immunity.
Now, with that first part, what this code, this legal, this law means, a citizen could not only sue for damages, but also you said injunctive relief, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, means you have to pay me, but also you have to stop doing this thing. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the statute on its face allows for a plaintiff to sue both for damages and for injunctive relief. And probably the best example of that is the city of is Floyd versus the city of New York, which was a case that was decided back in 2014. And what a class of plaintiffs did was that New York, particularly their street crimes unit, they alleged that New York police had a policy and practice of discriminating against Black and brown men, particularly men sort of in their mid-teens to lower 20s, and that they would stop them without probable cause. And so it was a violation of their Fourth Amendment rights, but also because they were targeting them because of their race, that this was also a violation of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. So in addition to wanting damages for the past harms caused by these stops, they also wanted New York to change their policy and practice so that they no longer targeted young Black and brown men in this way. So that would be probably the best example of how it can both serve to compensate for past injuries, but also to prevent future injuries. The problem is, though, is that while the statute says that on its face, the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the statute is that there has to be a standing requirement. And when I say that, what I mean is that the plaintiff has to have standing to bring that particular claim. And when it comes to a claim for injunctive relief, there has to be the threat of an immediate future injury. And so unless you can establish that there's a real risk that you're going to suffer the same injury again, then the court will hold that you don't have standing. So in a case where something like stop and frisk, where plaintiffs may actually be stopped multiple times, they're able to establish standing. In other cases, the case that actually established the standing doctrine was coincidentally a case involving a chokehold during a traffic stop. The court said there, well, it's unlikely that you're going to be stopped by police again, and that if you are stopped by police again, that they're going to use this chokehold absent any sort of provocation. And so you don't have standing to bring injunctive relief. You only have standing for the damages claim. And so it gets a little bit complex when you start digging into sort of the nuts and bolts of the doctrine. But the general idea is that Section 1983 is largely used for compensatory damages. So for those monetary actions, and that qualified immunity acts as a shield in those cases involving monetary damages.
Talking to Terry Ravenel, law professor at Villanova University, about qualified immunity, especially as it applies to police officers, what it means, where it came from, and the prospect, some calls to change that doctrine. You can join in with your thoughts on that and your questions at 800-642-1234. And Terry, you've mentioned qualified immunity came from this concept. It sounds like came from the U.S. Supreme Court. This is not something passed by Congress, signed by the president. It's the Supreme Court's interpretation of this law limiting it.
Yes, that's exactly right. As so many people have noted recently, qualified immunity is a judicially created doctrine. And so when you actually look at 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, and you can Google it and find it, but that's the statute that, again, provides the civil remedy for the deprivation of constitutional rights. And when you read through the statute, particularly when you read through it in its original language from 1871, there's absolutely no mention of any defenses. And so if somebody were just to pick up the statute, read it, you would assume that it provided liability in all cases. But what the court said, the statute essentially lay dormant for a number of years following the end of the Reconstruction era. And it wasn't until 1960 in a case called Monroe v. Pape where people really started to use the statute again. And then shortly thereafter, in the late 60s, is when we see the Supreme Court actually acknowledge the defense of good faith qualified immunity. And at that point, the immunity actually looked a little bit different. It was called good faith qualified immunity. And what the court reasoned was that the immunity existed at common law when the statute was passed back in 1871. And although Congress didn't mention the immunity, this defense, when it passed the statute, that it intended to incorporate the defense. Now, that's been called into question, and I'm actually in the middle of an article right now that goes back and sort of considers this origin story of both the Civil Rights Act of 1983 and qualified immunity. But it's a question that's being studied a lot more lately. And in fact, Justice Thomas recently called into question the origins of the qualified immunity doctrine. And so a lot of scholars have been writing and thinking about, one, whether it was intended to be incorporated, and if so, what it should look like or what it did look like at common law.
We're picking up our talk now with Terry Ravenel, law professor at Villanova University, looking at the principle of qualified immunity for police, what it means, how it affects policing, and some changes possibly in the works. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Terry, before we go to our callers, we've seen arguments that we need this qualified immunity, otherwise police are going to be exposed to frivolous lawsuits, might drive people out of the profession. Other people saying, no, this idea is being abused to protect police abuses. Where do you see it on that kind of continuum?
You know, I think that it's actually a little bit more complex than that. And it's a nuanced answer. And part of it depends on where you live in the country, quite frankly. What a recent study showed was that 99% of the cases in which police officers have been found liable, that the police officers are actually indemnified by their cities. And so when people talk about it, they're often talking about it in this very theoretical way. And that is, in fact, part of the justification behind the qualified immunity doctrine, is that if we did not protect our public servants in this way, that they wouldn't be inclined to serve. But one of the things that we have to recognize is that there's actually other solutions besides qualified immunity. So one of the things that we could do, and in fact, which does happen in practice, is that government officials could be indemnified for their liability so that, in fact, they don't have to shoulder the cost. And this is what is actually happening in practice. And so there's actually, I think, a middle ground about what is truly the answer. And the truth is that we don't necessarily need to fear that people won't join the police force and serve in this way. But what we have to highlight is that if we take away qualified immunity, that there is some other shield, which is, in fact, indemnification.
I'm going to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Connor is with us in Madison. Connor, hi.
Yeah, this is Connor. I actually called this morning to kind of get into this issue a little bit, because I think you really offer an interesting solution in terms of indemnification being sort of a middle ground. But what concerns me about policing in this day and age is that we have this perception on one hand that there are good apples in the police and just a few bad apples doing bad things. My experience, however, has been very different. I've experienced a lot of bad apples in the police, and I've been sexually assaulted by police officers in Wisconsin and received really just kind of a dismissive attitude from the police department investigating that. So it seems to me that qualified immunity has been used as a shield for these officers to continue to abuse me and a few other people who have, you know, frankly, through the victimization, have gone on to kind of ruin their own lives.
And I'm sorry to hear that that's happened to you. Thank you for sharing your experience, though. Terry, Connor sees qualified immunity as a shield for bad, in this case, he's claiming illegal behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, when we start talking about police violence, bringing lawsuits against the police, it's a really complicated subject matter. And qualified immunity is only one small piece of it. Establishing an underlying constitutional violation often requires evidence of a harm. And with things like the blue wall of silence and a lot of other sort of questions about how you establish that and questions of credibility when you have somebody who is testifying against a police official are really complicated. I tend to agree with Connor that I think that we often try to make it a question of good police versus bad police. And I think that that's an unfortunate way to look at it. And I think that it oversimplifies a really complicated area of the law. And I think that what's important to think about is not so much whether police are good or bad, but But what is the best training that we can give police officials in order to prevent these types of constitutional deprivations from happening in the first place? And that's one of the things that when we're talking about police reform more broadly, that people are really thinking about these days, things like de-escalation, not using no-knock warrants, the use of chokeholds, different techniques, whether or not police should be sent during mental health crises, whether there's other alternatives. These are the types of broader questions that don't necessarily implicate individual wrongdoing, but force us to look at policing more systematically. And I think that one of the things that is very useful about indemnification, or what we might even take a step further and talk about as vicarious liability for municipalities, is that it gives municipalities a very clear incentive to start rethinking the policies around policing. And I think that so long as we have more transparency and the budget about the cost of settling these types of lawsuits, I think that's going to lead to better public accountability about how we engage in policing, which is a really important function of civilized society, but that we have to think very carefully about, because police do have enormous power, as some of Connor's experiences have shown.
Thanks for the call, Connor. I want to make sure I've got the thread right here, Terry, with this indemnification idea. It's, yes, you can sue if your civil rights have been violated. The police officer, the individual, wouldn't be on the hook, but their department or their municipality or the local government. And that in turn would incentivize, if I run a city, I don't want to pay out lots of lawsuits like here. That's going to motivate me to change our patterns and practices. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. And, you know, one of the questions, too, is whether it's going to be indemnification or vicarious liability. Right now, we already operate on a system of indemnification. But whether or not a municipality is required to indemnify its officers can depend on a lot of different factors, like what the state statute at hand, if there's a police union contract that demands it. So that's why I said initially that it can vary a lot from place to place. Mm-hmm. But if we were to make a bigger move to vicarious liability, then we wouldn't have to sort of the question of whether or not the municipality would end up with the sort of financial burden would not depend on these additional factors, like police union contracts or indemnification statutes.
Let's go back to our callers now. Paul is with us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hello.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call. Great conversation. Came in kind of towards the end, so I didn't hear all of it, but I have some recent kind of statistics that I heard. 850,000 police officers in the United States, which kind of leads me to believe, in fact, they say the numbers are going up, that people aren't really dissuaded from going into law enforcement, which I actually think is good. I really do support law enforcement. Having been in the Marine Corps and having been schooled on excessive use of force, though, I heard some other statistics that were alarming to me, that in the last 10 years, 1,600 police officers were killed in the line of duty. Very tragic. In the last 15 years, over 16,000 Americans were killed by police officers, and only 7 police officers were held accountable of their actions. And that just seems so stark and so low that there has to be across-the-board federal accountability for what I seem to see as excessive use of force. And obviously, there's, you know, a whole continuum of whether or not a police officer is responsible in a specific situation. But those statistics, if they are accurate, are very concerning. I guess I'd like your guest to speak to.
Gotcha, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Just a couple of minutes left. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, Terry, but Paul, concerned that there's not enough accountability when police use deadly force.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, again, a very complicated question, Paul. I did jot down some of the numbers that you were talking about. One of the things that makes all of this very complicated is that back in 2014, when we first sort of started really seeing a lot of media attention on police killing, that summer that Michael Ferguson was murdered or was killed by police. And there were several other police killings that summer. It became very clear that we didn't actually even have a national database where we were tracking how many civilians were killed by police officials. And the Washington Post at that point started their own database. But that actually just goes to show part of the problem in the sense of we haven't actually done a very good job identifying the problem. I also think that you're correct when we think about accountability, but accountability is questionable in the sense of, are we talking about criminal accountability? Are we talking about civil accountability? What does accountability mean if the police official doesn't pay civil damages and the municipality does? Does that mean that the police official wasn't held accountable? What if there's some sort of, you know, internal discipline? Is that accountability enough? I think that what we saw with Derek Chauvin's case, and one of the things that people highlighted, was that there hasn't been a lot of criminal accountability. It's very, very seldom that on-duty police officers are actually charged with police violence. And if they are charged, it's even more seldom that they're actually convicted of it. So there's a much larger question about accountability. And then there's also lots of questions about what is excessive force. The way that the Supreme Court has adopted the standard right now is what they've essentially said is that if an officer believes that the person poses a threat to the officer or others, that they are able to use force, and in fact, deadly force. And so when you sort of see that happening, what often ends up occurring is that the officer says, I feared for my life, and maybe they did it that moment. But what the court does not typically consider are things like, could the officer have de-escalated the situation? So what I hope all this shows is that it's really complicated.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much to our guest, Terry Ravenel from Villanova University, looking at the concept of qualified immunity. There's more to come here on Central Time.